I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
One early morning in December of 2010, Anthony Tony Carleo rolled up to the Bellagio Hotel and Casino on the Las Vegas Strip. Dressed in a full motorcycle jumpsuit, gloves, and a helmet, he took out a pistol and robbed $1.5 million worth of casino chips. Not only did he rob the house, but soon after he returned, checked into the hotel, and began living like a king for free. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. This week on Podcast Playlist, you're going to want to keep your valuables safe because we're checking out stories about scammers. And before we get any further, just a warning, this episode contains mature themes. The new series, The High Roller Heist, tells the story of how Tony Carleo robbed Sin City's biggest casino and nearly got away with it. After years of collecting gambling debts, he decided that robbing a casino would be his ticket to freedom. But before Tony Carleo, Vegas already had an extensive history of mob wars and robbery. Here's The High Roller Heist with more. And a warning, this podcast discusses themes of violence and addiction.
It's no secret one of the most notorious gangsters in American history is a founding father of Las Vegas, responsible for installing a certain mob ethos that became the blueprint for how the city operated throughout the latter half of the 20th century. For nearly four decades after Bugsy's arrival, the Las Vegas Strip was run by a vast criminal enterprise. It was the lifeline for the American mafia, a safe haven for money laundering, a shelter to crooks who needed a place to lay low, a seedy adult playland with a notorious reputation for getting its visitors just about anything they wanted, as long as the money kept flowing. Of course, how much money was running through Vegas casinos during that time wasn't exactly clear. Mobsters aren't exactly known for their transparent bookkeeping. And as with any establishment that is flush with large sums of money at all times, it ultimately became a target for those in search of an easy score.
Every report will say that there was robberies going back to the 1930s, but they don't credit where those robberies happened, what were the details of those robberies. It's all kind of hush-hush. So the earliest robbery we could find that had a lot of details is actually an interesting one in 1951. It's the story of the two Tonys.
The two Tonys are Tony Brancato and Anthony Trombino, a couple of low-level gangsters who ran in the same circles as famed Los Angeles mob boss Mickey Cohen. And clouded by a mix of greed and ambition, they got into the bad habit of robbing people who the rest of the mafia world considered untouchable.
In 1951, they got caught stealing from a sports book in Las Vegas because they forgot to wear a mask and they were recognized.
But it's not just any sports book in Vegas. It's the Flamingo's sports book. And the guy who ran it, High Goldbaum, had been a victim of the two Tonys before, during a heist of his jewelry store back in Los Angeles. Goldbaum ID'd the two Tonys, and they were arrested, but they skipped bail and headed to Los Angeles to hide out.
But of course, the mob's there as well, and they know they're there. They weren't that bright because they decided to align with another mobster to go steal some more money.
That mobster was Aladina Fratiano, AKA Jimmy the Weasel. If you thought the two Tonys' intuition was skewed before, imagine trusting a guy nicknamed Jimmy the Weasel. And it was this lapse in judgment that would ultimately prove fatal. The aftermath photos of the two Tonys' execution are pure pulp noir. High contrast black and white images, two bodies beyond a spider-webbed windshield, pockmarked by bullet holes, car seats covered in blood, as dark as the night beyond. The lesson here is that when criminals are the ones being stolen from, there's no law to protect you, and no place is beyond their reach. And we're still finding relics of this bygone Las Vegas era today.
In Nevada, a grim discovery, a body found on the shore of Lake Mead, just outside of Las Vegas, inside this corroded barrel. Authorities have determined he was murdered 50 years ago.
Could it stem from organized crime or something completely different? That's what Lieutenant Ray Spencer's team will dig into if they can extract DNA from the remains.
But despite the mob's lawless approach to those who cross them, people still try to lie, cheat, and rob from their casinos.
This is where the cash is. It's like, bank robberies are bank robberies because that's where the money is. You go where the cash is.
That's Scott Robin, an independent Las Vegas journalist and founder of the popular X feed called Vital Vegas.
If you got caught cheating, this was not a situation where they would call 911. You would be taken to the basement and you would be strapped to a hot water pipe, naked, and they would wait until the boiling water would flush through the pipes and you would be reprimanded in that way.
These tactics were enough to keep the vast majority of gamblers honest inside the casinos, even if the management wasn't. But by the latter half of the 1970s, all of that began to change.
On May 18th, 1976, a traumatic rite of civic purification began. A small group of apprehensive state gaming control board agents raided the Stardust Casino, looking for evidence of the skim.
After a decade's worth of state and federal investigations, mob control of the casinos along the Vegas Strip and across much of the country crumbled. By the late 80s, the mob era in Vegas was dead. And the corporate era was beginning.
Fantasy becomes reality when the mirage appears on the Las Vegas Strip.
Residents flocked to the city, now free from organized criminal control, doubling the total population in just 10 years. Record-setting billion-dollar profits were publicly reported on an annual basis. And as a result, a new crop of ambitious thieves came to town.
Royal Harper was a Stardust security guard and used his two sons to imposter robbers, and they ended up stealing about $150,000. Then 6 months later, they tried it again. They attacked a guard carrying $1.1 million in cash and checks from an armored truck, using smoke bombs to conceal their escape. You have 1992, you have the big Stardust sportsbook cashier named William John Brenner, who walked out of the hotel with more than $500,000 in cash and gaming chips, is never seen again. 1993 is probably one of the most famous ones, and it was outside Circus Circus with an armored truck. Basically, the armored truck was actually filling ATM machines along the strip, and one of the armored truck drivers just decided to drive away while she was waiting for her co-workers to come back and ended up taking $2.9 million and was on the run for 12 years.
Long gone were the days of basement water pipe torture or strolls along the bottom of Lake Mead in cement shoes. But the parable of the two Tonys still makes its way through the backroom poker games and dive bars of the American West. Greed and ambition, unchecked, can be the end of you. For one Tony in particular, our Tony, this story could have been a wake-up call. But his debt, his addiction, and his general desperation made the insane idea of robbing a casino seem like his only way out.
It was a perfect storm of all these little different events. You find yourself destitute and with no money, no purpose. Like, I'd be passed out in my car sometimes in the driveway. I'd come home at like midnight, listening to like NPR or something on the way home, and then just sit in the driveway and fall asleep. It's embarrassing, but it was the world I was living in at that point. You do irrational things, man. It's like, not to blame it on that, but when you're in that little storm and the circumstances all line up, you're just not yourself.
That was a clip from The High Roller Heist. It's a production of Waveland from Audiochuck. This episode was created and produced by Eli Corris and Joshua Schaefer of Piccolo Pictures, and executive produced by Jason Hoke of Waveland. To hear more from this series, we'll have all the details on our website, cbc.ca/podcast playlist. To set you up for this next series, imagine the action of Ocean's 11 combined with the comedy of 30 Rock, carried out by a star-studded cast. Do I have you hooked? Well, Hot White Heist is a 6-part series from Audible.ca. It stars Bowen Yang, who you may know from the podcast Les Culturistas, or SNL. He plays Judy Fink, a fortune teller from New York City, who ends up getting recruited by his long-lost aunt to complete a special mission. Rather than having me explain it, though, let's hear her break it down. And just a heads up, this podcast contains mature themes that may not be suitable for younger listeners.
First, let me tell you about the bunker. Deep underneath the Space Needle in Seattle, about 5 stories down, but who's counting, there's a secret government bunker. You've never heard of it because it's a secret. That's how secrets work. To get into the bunker, first you have to convince Space Needle security that you have access to a special elevator. The elevator doesn't work unless you enter a 16-digit password and pass a facial scan. The facial scanner is a bit out of date, but the password is case-sensitive. Once you're out of the access elevator, almost 100 feet underground, the real fun begins. Space Needle security is just day players. Regular schlubs collecting a paycheck, but the folks guarding the bunker are legit. Highly trained paramilitary professionals contracted from a rotating selection of militias that make Black Cube look like Blue Man Group. If you manage to sneak past the guards or somehow fake clearance to get into the bunker itself, they've got a dynamic laser field running 24/7 hooked up to a backup generator with 3 levels of redundancy. So you can't just cut the power. Past the grid, there's just one thing between you and cold storage, but it's a doozy. A clean room. Like a really clean room. An experimental ventilation system creates a total vacuum, ensuring that any harmful particles are pulled off your body, your clothes, your shoes, and vented out of the bunker and, due to an architectural quirk, up into the gift shop at the Space Needle. If you're caught in the clean room during the vacuum protocol without a helmet on, the air inside your lungs will also be vented up into the gift shop. That's what a vacuum does. It sucks. And asphyxiating to death in an underground bunker really sucks. But let's say you manage to sneak past the security on the ground level, crack the 16-digit case-sensitive access elevator password, and trick the facial scanner. Outsmart a bunch of military-grade professional assholes, dance through a laser field, and survive the clean room lockdown. What for? What could possibly be worth all the trouble? What's in the bunker? The most valuable substance on Earth. Ronald Reagan's sperm.
Okay, well, I think we all just need to take a moment there and ponder that ending. A very surprising ending, but I think now we're all up to speed as to the context of this show. So let's get into the rest of this clip. We're going to open with Bowen Yang's character, Judy Fink, in the middle of Central Park, attempting to make a quick buck. Here's Hot White Heist.
Excuse me, do you know which way the Sex in the City apartment is?
That would be over on Perry Street. Make a left up there.
Thank you so much.
Visiting from out of town?
How could you tell?
Just a hunch. I love your shoes, by the way.
Thank you so much. I love yours. Those are some stilettos.
They keep me on my toes.
Oh, I bet they do.
What brings you to New York?
Well, I'm here with my church group, but this is my day off.
What a thrill. Everyone needs a day off. How are you going to spend it?
I'm not sure. What would you recommend?
Gosh, I mean, there are so many options. Why don't we ask the cards?
Oh, my. Are those?
Tarot cards. They can give you guidance or new perspective or even help you see your future.
I don't know. That sounds sort of occult, doesn't it?
Heavens no. Not occult. Just gay.
Oh, that's okay then, I guess.
You don't seem like a homophobe.
Oh, no. Not at all. Our choir director is a little funny, and he's a hoot.
Perfect. The initial reading is $15. Let's have you pick a card.
Okay. Here we go.
Wow. Fascinating. The Empress.
What does that mean?
Well, the Empress is a very auspicious card. She represents the power of a woman to take charge and get what she deserves. She's a diva and a girl boss.
Wow, that does sound like me.
Yes, queen, work, mama, etc. Want to do another one?
Well, sure, why not? Is that
another $15, yes, here we go. How lucky the Four of Swords reversed.
What's that one about?
Well, the Four of Swords represents defeat.
Ah.
So when it's reversed, that means you're overcoming something, like maybe a professional setback.
Huh.
Or a family issue?
Right.
Or some sort of romantic problem?
Oh my God!
That's the one.
Oh, I just got out of a relationship. That is incredible.
The cards don't lie, and neither do I.
You know, I guess it's true. Gay men really do make great best friends.
We are best friends, aren't we? How about one more card before you go eat a cronut or whatever?
Sure.
Well, okay.
What is that card?
I wouldn't jump to conclusions. It's not necessarily...
It looks like Satan.
You know, it is in a certain sense Satan, but sort of...
That seems bad. The devil is bad.
I understand that it could definitely seem bad to an outside observer, but within the vocabulary of tarot, the devil just means something... else, something different, you know?
I mean, it doesn't look like a happy card.
Looks aren't everything. Looks can be deceiving. You can't tell
Judy,
just by...
Judy, Judy.
Wait, what?
Hi, honey.
Aunt Kate? What are you doing here?
You two know each other?
I'd like to think so.
Hey, is this like some kind of scam?
No, nothing like that. Although I have to say, that's a very liberal interpretation of the devil card.
Liberal? What do you mean?
Could you not?
Most serious interpreters of the tarot understand the devil to represent the seductive power of the physical, the material world dragging you down, being held in bondage by your desires, the inability to escape or change.
I like his interpretation better.
Who are you going to trust on this one? Some stranger you met in a park or an honest-to-God lesbian?
You know, I think I have to go.
Actually, the beauty of the tarot lies
Bye.
In its...
And there she goes.
Infinite and equally valid interpretations. By all means, have a seat.
I think I will.
She's about to cough up like $200. Tourist on a church group tour? Fresh out of a relationship? Catastrophic die drop and tragic heels? The motherlode.
You look well.
You look about the same as I remember you, believe it or not.
Lesbians don't shrivel. We ripen. It's been a while.
I hadn't been keeping track.
I have, believe it or not.
Well, not that it isn't great to see you, but I'm actually out here trying to make rent, so maybe we can catch up later.
I'm in a bit of a hurry, so now would be better for me. Come on. I didn't fly all the way from Montana to not buy you lunch.
Montana?
Where can we go for a burger around here? Julius, I can't believe this place is still here.
New York's oldest gay bar.
I feel like this might be New York's oldest hamburger, honestly. It's really good to see you.
What are you doing here, Kate?
Can't a concerned aunt stop by to see her favorite nephew once in a while?
Once in a while?
I know.
15 years. 15 years. What happened? Where did you go?
It's a long story.
You disappeared. You said you flew here from Montana? Is that where you've been?
Yes.
This whole time?
Look, Judy, I'm sorry. I mean it. The time I spent living with you and your mother was... That time was precious to me. But I couldn't stay there forever. I mean, I was the age you are now. Can you imagine? I know that's not... But I met someone.
And you moved with this person to Montana?
Her name is Brenda. She's really something special. But it's never been just about Brenda. It's bigger than that.
Like a thruple?
Not quite.
So like a polycule?
No. It's bigger than that. The group is... It's a coalition, is what it is.
A coalition?
Yes, it's a group of like-minded individuals with similar goals.
Oh, I see. So it's a cult.
It's not.
What you're describing is for sure a cult.
It's not a cult, I promise.
Okay, and how many of you are there in this allegedly not a cult?
Just under 150 women. People. Queer individuals. We're not TERFs.
I didn't say you were.
I know, but we're not, okay?
Does this coalition have a name?
Of course. The Coalition of Lesbians Intent on Taking Over.
How have I never heard of this?
Brenda wanted a place for herself, for all of us, and she couldn't find it. So she created one. And then over time, the others showed up, the true believers.
Are there, like, uniforms?
Ugh, don't be ridiculous.
It's a fair question.
What happened was the group took a vote and decided that everyone just likes wearing very similar outfits. They're not uniforms. They're not uniforms.
Got it. So you abandoned your single mom sister and her baby gay son to go to Montana and wear not uniforms at a not cult run by militant queer separatist lesbians.
I didn't say anything about being militant, but yes. And also we are.
I don't know what you want me to say to that. That sucked. You meant a lot to me, Aunt Kate. In a sort of ring of keys sort of way, and it was really upsetting.
Look, Jude.
Don't. Nobody calls me that.
Do you know why nobody calls you that?
Because I've been introducing myself as Judy for 20 years?
Because I started calling you Judy when you bought those ruby slippers and started clacking around the basement in them when you were 5.
Mom threw those away.
She threw them away 3 times. I kept taking them out of the trash and giving them back to you.
Gross, but sweet.
I'm here because I think there might be a way I can make it up to you for leaving. It's a job. A gig, really. It's just a one-time thing.
I appreciate that, but I don't need whatever, like, internship at GLAAD you have lined up. I'm doing all right.
All appearances to the contrary.
Hey, that tourist was perfectly happy with the service she was receiving until you showed up.
That's because she was an idiot. You're capable of so much more than weaponizing the ancient bond between gay men and straight women to trick strangers out of their pocket change, Judy. Trust me.
I did not ask you to lunch so you could on my whole, like, lifestyle.
You didn't ask me to lunch at all. You agreed to come because I offered to pay for you, so hear me out, okay?
Okay, fine. Jesus.
First, let me tell you about the bunker.
That was a clip from Hot White Heist. It's an Audible original. The show is created by Adam Goldman. That clip featured the voices of Bowen Yang, Cynthia Nixon, and Eva Victor. Season 2 of Hot White Heist is set to drop on March 7th, and the cast includes the likes of Tom Hanks, Whoopi Goldberg, Zach Galifianakis, Janelle James, Chloe Fineman, and David Harbour. If you want to catch up on Season 1, you can listen to the show through audible.ca or wherever you get your podcasts. Funny enough, this next podcast also has a connection to Ronald Reagan, because that's what we're doing today, folks. In 1970s America, there was a sense that welfare had become a crisis. When Reagan was governor, he described welfare as a cancer eating at our vitals. At the same time, the economy wasn't doing very well. So you had rising costs and paychecks that didn't match the rate of inflation. But instead of blaming the system, who got blamed instead? Black women on welfare. One woman in particular ended up becoming the face of the stereotype. Her name was Linda Taylor. And despite her numerous other crimes, like kidnapping, assault, theft, and potentially murder, she went on to be known as the Welfare Queen. NPR's Code Switch explores this moment in history. With more, here's co-host Gene Demby and his guest Josh Levin, the national editor at Slate.
So what was happening in the intervening years between when she leaves the South and when she takes up this, like, criminal career in Chicago?
So she first goes out west. She goes to Washington State and she goes to California. And when she's in both of those places, she's arrested on charges related to prostitution. Mm-hmm. And my sense is she was somebody who was systematically denied education when she was a child because of her race. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, you know, when she's out in California in the 40s, she did not have a stable existence there. She ends up moving back to the Deep South for a while around where she grew up. And then she heads north in the late 50s and early 60s to Illinois. And she moves to the south side of Chicago. She's there for 15 or 20 years. It's the place where she kind of establishes a foothold in the world.
So if you take us back to the fall of 1974, right, when newspapers around the country are starting to write about this woman, what were those stories saying?
They were saying that she had used dozens of different aliases to scam the Illinois Department of Public Aid to get welfare checks under different names at different addresses. And they said that the fruits for her were luxury cars. She had a Cadillac. She claimed to own four buildings on the South Side. And the first Tribune story about her mentioned she was about to leave on a Hawaiian vacation. So the suggestion here was not only was she scamming the government and scamming taxpayers, she was becoming rich.
And it's in one of those headlines in which someone uses the term welfare queen for the first time, right?
Yeah, the first time that I found was early October 1974. It was a newspaper in Rochester that used the term welfare queen the first time. And then about 10 days after that, the Chicago Tribune put it in a headline. And the Chicago Tribune really popularized the term in connection with her and used it in more than 40 different stories.
Wow.
Over the course of a couple of years. So the Tribune wasn't the first, but they were the ones that really cemented that term and also cemented the connection of the term to the specific woman and what she'd done.
During her moment of media infamy, she was doing a lot to inflame it, right? She was showing up to court in the, like, the flashiest stuff, right? I mean, she was...
Yeah.
You almost could not have found someone who, like, better sort of embodied these, like, racist fears about someone living off the dole and living high off the dole, right?
Yeah, her defense attorney, Skip Gant, told me that one of his great frustrations in representing her in the 70s when she was on trial for welfare fraud was that he could not get her to appear demure in court. He asked her to tone down what she wore because he knew, you know, this was a jury that was three quarters white. He knew that there was a risk that she would be perceived as the woman that people thought that she was, the mm-hmm. Cadillac driving welfare queen. But he said that she refused to tone down the way she dressed. She would still wear fur coats. And he believes that she had this need to be defiant, to kind of thumb her nose at society and at her critics, that was, for whatever reason, more important to her than following her lawyer's advice and appearing to be a conservative. You know, he described as, I wanted her to look like a lady who worked for the IRS. Like, she was not gonna look that way.
She was most famous for the welfare fraud stuff, but in your initial write-up in Slate, you write that she was implicated in this infamous child kidnapping.
Yeah, so I should say that there's a lot that we don't know. She was arrested for kidnapping in Chicago in 1967 in connection to a case where a little girl who was in her care that was given to her by the girl's mother, that she just took the child and wouldn't give the kid back. Mm-hmm. And then there were other cases where she would just show up with kids that hadn't belonged to her, that they would appear and disappear. And there were several documented cases and then others that I was told about where she was never arrested or charged, where she took other people's children. And you mentioned the 1964 kidnapping from a hospital in Chicago, which was a huge national story and remains unsolved. The kid's name is Paul Joseph Fronczak. This was a kid who was a day old who was taken from his mother's arms in the maternity ward in this hospital by a woman dressed as a nurse. The woman left and was never seen again. The child was never seen again. Linda Taylor, at around that time, told people that she was a nurse. She dressed as a nurse. She lived in the area at the time. There were claims that someone using one of her aliases and fitting her description had been in or around the hospital at the time. A decade later, a man that she was living with said that he believed that she had done it, but there's nothing there that's solid and ironclad. But if I was investigating the case back in the 60s, I definitely would have wanted to talk to her.
Mm-hmm. But no one hunted her down?
No.
Mm. So there were the kidnappings, but there were also the mysterious deaths.
Yeah, so in 1975, Taylor was out on bond. She'd been arrested for welfare fraud in 74, and she had become known as the Welfare Queen in 74. She gets out on bail. She moves in with this woman named Patricia Parks, who lived on the south side of Chicago. This is a friend that she had met at church. And Patricia Parks was sick, and Taylor said that she could come in and help take care of her. And when she moved in, Parks started getting sicker and sicker. And then at a certain point, Patricia created a will that gave everything to Taylor. With all this is happening, she's getting sicker, and she dies in June of 1975, and she is found to have overdosed on barbiturates. This is extremely suspicious.
Mm-hmm.
And the person who had reported the death was Linda Taylor, her friend, who she had just signed her house over to. And it's investigated as a potential homicide. It's looked into. But eventually, the prosecutor, same guy who was prosecuting her for welfare fraud, decides there's not enough evidence to charge her. She did not at least end up getting the woman's estate, but Patricia Parks' family believes that Taylor killed her. You know, at the time, and this is what the family told me, the potential killing of a Black woman in Chicago was just, like, not a story that was of national interest or even local interest for the predominantly white newspapers.
But
whereas welfare fraud
perpetrated by a Black woman.
Yeah. Taylor was the welfare queen. She wasn't a killer or a kidnapper. Like, that actually, whether it was for Ronald Reagan or Illinois politicians, it's like that doesn't really help sell the storyline. And so it was just really erased from her story. So when she gets convicted of welfare fraud and sent to prison in Illinois, she goes in 1978. That was, as far as I was able to find in my reporting, the first time that she had actually done a like long-term hitch in prison. And then she essentially ceased to exist. And the interesting thing is that the story about her, the story that Reagan tells or that gets told in the press, is really fixed in time. It never changes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though it would kind of potentially help his story, Reagan doesn't talk about her trial, doesn't talk about her being convicted. He just talks about how many different names she used, how much money she stole. Like, mm-hmm. That's the important stuff. Anything that, like, happened after that is just kind of seen as irrelevant.
Even the more nefarious stuff, even though that stuff was, like, obviously much more consequential to actual people's lives.
Yeah, and it actually helps emphasize the point that she was an outlier. Welfare fraud is the thing that happens. The thing that does not typically happen is that someone kidnaps people, murders people, and also is, yeah, maybe they're stealing some welfare money too. If you have the full picture, she doesn't stand for anything but herself, right?
From NPR, that was Code Switch. That episode was co-hosted by Gene Demby and Shireen Marisol Meraji. It was produced by Maria Paz Gutierrez. If you want to stay up to date on all things podcast playlists, follow us on Spotify or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.
Hello, I'm Jess Milton. For 15 years, I produced The Vinyl Cafe with the late, great Stuart McLean. Every week, more than 2 million people tuned in to hear funny, fictional, feel-good stories about Dave and his family. We're excited to welcome you back to the warm and welcoming world of The Vinyl Cafe with our new podcast, Backstage at The Vinyl Cafe. Each week, we'll share 2 hilarious stories by Stuart, and for the first time ever, I'll tell you what it was like behind the scenes. Subscribe for free wherever you get your podcasts.
Chameleon is a podcast series that explores scams hiding in plain sight. The show is many seasons deep, and today we're going to hear from their season, Scam Likely. when a small team of government investigators learn that ordinary people across the U.S. are losing their life savings to scam callers, they try to find who's behind it. The investigation takes them internationally, from strip malls in suburban Texas to office towers in one of India's largest cities. In this clip, we're going to hear the scam in action.
Yes, IRS, how can I help you?
Yeah, I received a call from this number.
Okay, and what was the call about?
They said something about my attorney and to call some kind of paperwork.
This is what a scam call sounds like. We got this recording from the federal investigators.
Okay, and is that I'm speaking with Chris Wong?
Yes, that's me.
This caller is claiming to be from the IRS, and he tells this guy, Chris Wong, that he owes the IRS $1,200.
There's no way I can come up with $1,200, not even close.
So how much you can come up with?
I have less than $75 on me.
I see.
The caller isn't going to settle for that, so he makes a threat.
Then I'm sorry, unfortunately, I need to disconnect this phone line and I need to start my legal procedure. You just reach the home, wait for the cops. Within 30 minutes, they will be there and it will be big trouble for you. You will be arrested and you will be behind the bars for 5 years. Okay, Chris?
No, all right? That's not okay. No.
Okay, but I don't, no problem, but we need to follow some rules and regulations. I'm bounded with my job. And unfortunately, we have to take the legal action against you. So be ready to get arrested. We will meet in courthouse tomorrow.
Me?
Yeah.
No, but they don't need to arrest me. This is...
That was enough to frighten Chris. So he said, okay, I can try to figure out a way to get more than $75. Just don't send the cops. A new voice comes on the line, giving him orders that you are now familiar with.
Go to the ATM, try to withdraw the $500. Once you have a $500 with you, you can let me know after that I can guide you further what you need to do in order to submit at this payment. All right?
All right. Hold on. I'll call you back. Call you back at this number?
No. Do not disconnect this phone call. I'll be with you over the phone. You don't worry. This is a toll-free number. You wouldn't be charged anything for this call. So just hold this line. Be with me over the phone. Do not disconnect this phone call.
In a lot of ways, this sounds like your typical scam call. But there's one big thing that's unusual about it. The scam victim you're hearing? His name isn't actually Chris Wong.
I'm Dylan. I've been with the Department of Homeland Security for 16, 17 years.
Dylan was one of Chris and Dave's closest collaborators, another key member of the crew of guys that gave it. He was in the middle of the investigation, and he was on this call because he wanted to understand how the scam worked from a victim's point of view. Why a victim would fall for it, what tactics the scammers used. He stuck on the phone for well over an hour. So long, the scammers didn't always keep up their professional demeanor.
Bless you. Is that a sneeze or a burp?
Sorry, but I'm not getting what are you trying to say?
Oh, made some kind of noise, sorry.
All right.
But Dylan wasn't on the phone to simply mess with the scammers. He was role-playing 100%, trying to learn their strategies, actually following the instructions he was being given.
That was one of the ways that I could psychologically be convincing, is if I'm actually doing it. And it's a good thing I did, because one of the tests, you know, they say, are you in your car? Yeah, I'm driving to the store. Okay, honk your horn.
Are you still driving?
Yeah.
Can you please blow the horn?
What's that?
Can you please blow the horn? All right, great.
This was all part of what Dylan was learning, how the scammers got into the heads of the victims, asking Dylan to honk his horn sounded innocuous, but it was part of a strategy to make sure he was actually following orders and to dominate him. I say jump, you jump.
So can you write down your case number?
Case number? Yeah, hold on. Hold on just a second. I don't even know if I have a pen. Give me just a second, sir.
Yeah, take your time.
To the caller, Dylan sounded compliant, like he'd taken the bait.
So they have all of these ways that are time-tested to really get to the bottom of, is this going to be a true victim or not? And, you know, they've done this so many times that they just keep building methodology, and it aggregates over time to where they are methodically managing these scenarios for maximum impact.
The way Dylan puts it, the voices on the phone are almost hypnotizing the people they call.
They are using a lot of subliminal techniques, neuro-linguistic and other techniques. One of the things I hear frequently that I think falls in that category is they ask a lot of questions in the beginning of the phone call to get you to say yes, right? So they want to develop the pattern of you saying yes so that 15 minutes from now when we get to the part where you're going to go to Walmart and buy these store value cards, you're saying yes.
Psychological insight. That's one thing Dylan brought to the team. The other? He was an expert at tracking down digital information that most people could never hope to find. You could call him a master of cyberstalking. His specialty was combing through immigration databases, car registrations, banking records, you name it, and then connecting the dots.
If you're only looking at a small piece of it, you're just not going to make those connections. You have to look at everything, and this can take years, as we found out.
Yeah, this is almost like a big data problem, you know, yes. Like an AI type of problem, I'm sure.
And we were working it manually, which was very painful.
He means doing it without any help from software tools. Dylan is shorter and slender. He looks boyish, the opposite of an intimidating cop. If Chris was the calculating strategist of the team and Dave the battering ram who could push through all roadblocks, Dylan was the analyst forever connecting the dots. He's quiet, deliberate, but beneath the surface, he has this high voltage intensity and a Christian faith that runs deep.
So yeah, it's a paradox, right? Because I believe we're called to pursue justice, right, in this world. But I don't believe justice is possible in this world. It's only for God to sort out. And so although we pursue justice, you know, it may inevitably not come in this life, right? But that doesn't mean we don't pursue justice.
That was a clip from Chameleon, Scam Likely. It's a production of Campside Media and Sony Music Entertainment. It's hosted by Udigit Bhattacharjee. He also produced the show with Eric Benson and Johnny Kaufman. This next podcast ties in well with the last one that we just heard. Scams of all kinds have become so commonplace. They can show up on your phone, through your email, or as you're browsing the web. And these days, it's not just a matter of if you'll get scammed, but when. So what should you do if you come across something suspicious? This clip from NPR's Life Kit shares a few red flags that you can look out for to protect yourself, your finances, and your information.
Anyone can get scammed. That's our takeaway one. Understand that it could happen to you. These warnings are not just for folks with memory issues or people who don't understand technology. And scammers, they want your money, whether you have a lot or a little.
Criminals will steal from anyone, whether you have $5 or $500 or $500,000.
Also, as I mentioned earlier, They may want your personal information, like your social security number, so they can steal your identity and then take on debt in your name. The other thing is, it doesn't matter how old you are. There are scams targeted at your age group. Back to Kelly Richmond Pope, who we heard from earlier, she's a university professor, and she warns her students about scholarship scams.
If you are in college or graduate school and you see an advertisement for a scholarship, that scholarship could be asking for so much information about you. It could ask if you have a tax return, do you have one? What's your name? What's your birth date? What's your parents' name? What's your mother's maiden name? How old are you? Where do you go to school? And sometimes you don't know that this is a fake scholarship. It doesn't exist.
The same thing can happen with fake job applications or websites that pretend to offer student debt relief. Another common scam involves cryptocurrency, where someone tells you they've got a great opportunity for you to invest in crypto and then they steal your money. Amy says sometimes this starts with a simple wrong number text.
You'll get a text message to your device and it says, "Hey, are you coming for dinner tonight?" And you, as a good human, writes back and say, "I'm sorry, you know, I think you have the wrong number. Who is this?" And they'll write back and they'll say, "Oh, isn't this Sally? Oh, I'm so sorry. You know, I thought I had my friend Sally's phone number. But you sound really nice. Like, where are you located?"
Then the conversation's flowing and they ask you a seemingly innocuous question like,
"What do you like to do for fun?" "I play baseball. I do this." "Oh, I dabble in crypto. I learned it from my aunt, who's a, you know, world-known crypto investor."
Maybe you've always wondered if you're missing out on the whole crypto thing. And next thing you know, you're transferring money to this person's digital crypto wallet and you'll never see it again. There are also imposter scams, where you get a phone call or a text from somebody pretending to be an institution, like your bank or a government agency.
It could be a text message from someone saying that there's a package waiting for you from the Postal Service. It could be someone calling you and saying that they're with the DEA and they found a car that was rented in your name and social security number and drugs were in it. You know, whatever it is, the imposter scams are rampant.
And these can be sophisticated. One of our producers got a phone call recently from somebody saying, "Hey, it's your bank. We think there's been a fraudulent charge on your account. Did you make this purchase?" So she logged into her account online and saw that there was a fraudulent charge on there from that place. But something felt off. The person on the phone had pronounced her name wrong and was asking for personal information. So she hung up and called her bank directly. Turns out that person was a scammer, and presumably they had made the fraudulent charge. It's clever, right? That brings us to takeaway two. Learn the red flags of a scam. Amy says if someone contacts you, whoever they're claiming to be, listen carefully. If they ask for payment, that's a red flag.
If they are asking or say in any part of the conversation, "prepaid gift card, government card," stop. If they say anything about a QR code or an ATM machine, stop. If they say anything about a peer-to-peer app like Venmo, Cash App, or Zelle, 100% stop. The government does not take payment with Venmo. If they say social security number or Medicare number, you know, "We need to verify this for, you know, legitimate purposes," stop.
Another red flag is requesting that you go get cash from an ATM or go to a store and ship them something.
Just stop. Just stop right there.
Now, here's a very specific but common one. If they're claiming to be the IRS, stop.
You call the IRS.
The IRS typically reaches out to taxpayers through good old snail mail. But these phone calls prey on our fear and uncertainty.
When you get that IRS call, you're like, "Oh my gosh, have I paid? Did I not pay? What's going to happen if I don't?" So they know that that's how you're going to respond.
That brings us to another red flag. Scammers will often try to trigger your emotions. They want you to feel scared or nervous so that you're not making clear-headed decisions. Those feelings should make your antenna go up. This happens in romance scams, where somebody you've been chatting with online tells you they're stuck in another country and their passport got stolen, for instance, and they just need you to Venmo them enough money to get home. It also happens in kidnapping scams, where someone pretends they've taken your family member captive. If you feel your emotions rising, pay attention. Another red flag is urgency. Is the person on the phone saying something needs to happen right now? That's another sign of a scam. And in those moments, don't be afraid to hang up.
get out of that situation. Like, literally get out of that situation. Hang up the phone, delete the email, and check on it.
Amy says, in general, you should treat everyone you meet online or through your phone as you would a stranger in person.
So imagine you're in your downtown area and someone runs up to you and says, oh my gosh, I have the best crypto opportunity for you right now. Do you want to go meet my aunt? Because she can invest your money, right? Or someone runs up to you and says, oh my gosh, you are the prettiest person I've ever met. I think I love you. If you're face to face, you'd be like, step away from me now.
Once you have stepped away or hung up or disengaged and you want to look into whatever this is, be careful. Like, let's say you got an email with a scholarship opportunity. Don't immediately click the links in the email and just do some research. Kelly suggests that you find a way to verify that scholarship is real using 3 to 5 other sources.
A lot of times when we're desperate, we don't do the verification piece. And that's what the scammers are preying on, is our desperation and our busyness and the lack of time.
Now let's take a different scenario. Say you get a call from someone claiming to be your bank. You're going to hang up and call the bank directly. Now this is important. Don't just Google the customer support number, because scammers have placed fake customer service numbers online.
So when an individual goes to, you know, a search engine and types in the phone number for PNC Bank, whatever it is, and just says PNC Bank customer service, the criminals are placing these fake customer service phone numbers. You call it thinking you're talking to your actual bank because you did your due diligence. You called the number. You looked it up.
But it's a fake number. So always call the number on the back of your bank card or on your account statement. And same goes for government agencies, airlines, and other institutions. Make sure you're at their correct website and find the number that way. Now, if you thought you were only at risk while browsing the internet, not so fast. Picture this. You're walking on a trail, and a teenager comes up to you and says,
oh my gosh, I lost my phone. I need to call my mom to pick me up. Can I borrow your phone, please? Well, of course. Here's my phone. You know, you see them dialing a phone number. But actually, what they've done is they've gone into your Venmo or your other peer-to-peer app, and they're basically just transferring money out of your account to them.
That brings us to takeaway 3. Proactively protect yourself from scams and fraud. So the first thing Amy says here is that if a stranger does want to borrow your phone,
first of all, put it on speaker, you dial the number, you keep control of your phone, but also always sign out of any banking apps.
That means Venmo and Cash App and whatever else. Make sure you sign out of those apps every time you're done using them. This is just one of many precautions you can take to protect yourself from scams. And yes, some of these things will be inconvenient and they may seem like overkill, but
it's just like how we, you know, none of us want to be broken into in our houses. But we lock our doors at night. We have alarms. We set up barriers. We need to do the same thing when it comes to scams and frauds and our financial safety and security.
That was Life Kit from NPR. That episode was hosted by Marielle Segarra. It was produced by Claire Marie Schneider. So let's do a quick check. Are your pockets good? You have everything you came with? Phone, wallet? Okay, great. Well, that's all the time we have for you today. I hope you heard some great scam podcasts that you want to check out. If you've heard of any great ones, please send your recommendations our way. And please no weird, suspicious links. You can email us at podcastplaylist@cbc.ca or find us on Facebook at CBC Podcast Playlist. Podcast Playlist is Kelsey Cueva and Julian Uzielli, with technical support from Laura Antonelli. Our senior producer is Kate Evans. Our executive producer is Cecil Fernandez. I'm Leah Simone Bowen. I'm going to go change all my passwords now. Until next time.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.